Hello, my name is Ginger Feldman from High and Mighty Therapeutic Riding and Driving Center, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC ACRA.
Hello, listeners. My name is Rachel Ann Schulman from the Campa Hudson Radio Group. Campa Hudson Radio Program led by live interview, noble guests in the local swing countries are from the local organization and ask them what they do in their communities, what shaped their life of growing up where they are now. We also occasionally talk about sport news and other subjects and interests, such as the upcoming community events and culture happening in the area. Tune in on the fourth Sunday of every month at 3:30 in the afternoon on 90.7 FM. Past interviews are available.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends, and enemies, it is now 12:02 a.m., Monday, 7th day of April, 2025, according to a certain reckoning. And you're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas. The name of the show, Goodnight Norman, right here on WGXC Radio for Open Ears, 90.7 FM, broadcasting to you from Catskill, New York. As usual, I'm going to read some fiction tonight. As you can hear the pages of the book I'm holding, I'm going to read a story by Washington Irving, notorious for his early depiction of Catskill in the famous story Rip Van Winkle. There's a bridge between the town of Catskill and the city of Hudson, where I live, named after that fictional character, the Rip Van Winkle Bridge. The name of this story by Washington Irving is The Adventure of the German Student. On a stormy night in the tempestuous times of the French Revolution, a young German was returning to his lodgings at a late hour across the old part of Paris. The lightning gleamed, and the loud claps of thunder rattled through the lofty, narrow streets. But I should now tell you something about this young German. Gottfried Wolfgang was a young man of good family. He had studied for some time at Göttingen, but being of a visionary and enthusiastic character, he had wandered into those wild and speculative doctrines which have so often bewildered German students. His secluded life, his intense application, and the singular nature of his studies had an effect on both mind and body. His health was impaired, his imagination diseased. He had been indulging in fanciful speculations on spiritual essences until, like Swedenborg, he had an ideal world of his own around him. He took up a notion, I do not know from what cause, that there was an evil influence hanging over him, an evil genius or spirit seeking to ensnare him and ensure his perdition. Such an idea, working on his melancholy temperament, produced the most gloomy effects. He became haggard and desponding. His friends discovered the mental malady preying upon him and determined that the best cure was a change of scene. He was sent, therefore, to finish his studies amidst the splendors and gaieties of Paris. Wolfgang arrived at Paris at the breaking out of the Revolution. The popular delirium at first caught his enthusiastic mind, and he was captivated by the political and philosophical theories of the day, but the scenes of blood which followed shocked his sensitive nature, disgusted him with society and the world, and made him more than ever a recluse. He shut himself up in a solitary apartment in the Pays Latin, the quarter of the students. There is a gloomy street not far from the monastic walls of the Sorbonne. There, in a gloomy street, not far from the monastic walls of the Sorbonne, he pursued his favorite speculations. Sometimes he spent hours together in the great libraries of Paris, those catacombs of departed authors, rummaging among their hoards of dusty and obsolete works in quest of food for his unhealthy appetite. He was, in a manner, a literary ghoul, feeding in the charnel house of decayed literature. Wolfgang, though solitary and reclusive, was of an ardent temperament, but for a time it operated merely upon his imagination. He was too shy and ignorant of the world to make any advances to the fair, but he was a passionate admirer of female beauty, and in his lonely chamber would often lose himself in reveries on forms and faces which he had seen, and his fancy would deck out images of loveliness far surpassing the reality. While his mind was in this excited and sublimated state, a dream produced an extraordinary effect upon him. It was of a female face of transcendent beauty. So strong was the impression made that he dreamt of it again and again. It haunted his thoughts by day, his slumbers by night. In fine, he became passionately enamored of this shadow of a dream. This lasted so long that it became one of those fixed ideas which haunt the minds of melancholy men and are at times mistaken for madness. Such was Gottfried Wolfgang, and such a situation at the time I mentioned. He was returning home late, one stormy night, through some of the old and gloomy streets of the Marais, the ancient part of Paris. The loud claps of thunder rattled among the high houses of the narrow streets. He came to the Place de Grève, the square where public executions are performed. The lightning quivered about the pinnacles of the ancient Hôtel de Ville and shed flickering gleams over the open space in front. As Wolfgang was crossing the square, he shrank back with horror at finding himself close by the guillotine. It was the height of the Reign of Terror when this dreadful instrument of death stood ever ready, and its scaffold was continually running with the blood of the virtuous and the brave. It had that very day been actively employed in the work of carnage, and there it stood in grim array amidst a silent and sleeping city waiting for fresh victims. Wolfgang's heart sickened within him, and he was turning, shuddering from the horrible engine, when he beheld a shadowy form cowering, as it were, at the foot of the steps which led up to the scaffold. A succession of vivid flashes of lightning revealed it more distinctly. It was a female figure, dressed in black. She was seated on one of the lower steps of the scaffold, leaning forward, her face hid in her lap, and her long, disheveled tresses hanging to the ground, streaming with the rain, which fell in torrents. Wolfgang paused. There was something awful in this solitary monument of woe. The female had the appearance of being above the common order. He knew the times to be full of vicissitude, and that many a fair head, which had once been pillowed on down, now wandered homeless. Perhaps this was some poor mourner, whom the dreadful axe had rendered desolate, and who sat here, heartbroken, on the strand of existence, from which all that was dear to her had been launched into eternity. He approached and addressed her in the accents of empathy. She raised her head and gazed wildly at him. What was his astonishment at beholding, by the bright glare of the lightning, the very face which had haunted him in his dreams? It was pale and disconsolate, but ravishingly beautiful. Trembling with violent and conflicting emotions, Wolfgang again accosted her. He spoke something of her being exposed at such an hour of the night, and to the fury of such a storm, and offered to conduct her to her friends. She pointed to the guillotine with a gesture of dreadful signification. "I've no friend on earth," she said. "But you have a home," said Wolfgang. "Yes, in the grave." The heart of the student melted at the words. "If a stranger dare make an offer," said he, "without danger of being misunderstood, I would offer my humble dwelling as a shelter, myself as a devoted friend. I am friendless myself in Paris, and a stranger in the land, but if my life could be of service, it is at your disposal, and should be sacrificed before harm or indignity should come to you." There was an honest earnestness in the young man's manner that had its effect. His foreign accent, too, was in his favor. It showed him not to be a hackneyed inhabitant of Paris. Indeed, there is an eloquence in true enthusiasm that is not to be doubted. The homeless stranger confided herself implicitly to the protection of the student. He supported her faltering steps across the Pont Neuf, and by the place where the statue of Henry IV had been overthrown by the populace. The storm had abated, and the thunder rumbled at a distance. All Paris was quiet. That great volcano of human passion slumbered for a while, to gather fresh strength for the next day's eruption. The student conducted his charge through the ancient streets of the Pays Latin, and by the dusky walls of the Sorbonne, to the great dingy hotel which he inhabited. The old portress, who admitted them, stared with surprise at the unusual sight of the melancholy Wolfgang with a female companion. On entering his apartment, the student, for the first time, blushed at the scantiness and indifference of his dwelling. He had but one chamber, an old-fashioned salon, heavily carved and fantastically furnished with the remains of former magnificence, for it was one of those hotels in the quarter of the Luxembourg Palace which had once belonged to nobility. It was lumbered with books and papers and all the usual apparatus of a student, and his bed stood in a recess at one end. When lights were brought, and Wolfgang had a better opportunity of contemplating the stranger, he was more than ever intoxicated by her beauty. Her face was pale, but of a dazzling fairness, set off by a profusion of raven hair that hung cluttering about it. Her eyes were large and brilliant, with a singular expression approaching almost to wildness. As far as her black dress permitted her shape to be seen, it was of perfect symmetry. Her whole appearance was highly striking, though she was dressed in the simplest style. The only thing approaching to an ornament which she wore was a broad black band round her neck, clasped by diamonds. The perplexity now commenced with the student. The perplexity now commenced with the student how to dispose of the helpless being thus thrown upon his protection. He thought of abandoning his chamber to her and seeking shelter for himself elsewhere. Still, he was so fascinated by her charms, there seemed to be such a spell upon his thoughts and senses that he could not tear himself from her presence. Her manner, too, was singular and unaccountable. She spoke no more of the guillotine. Her grief had abated. The attentions of the student had first won her confidence and then, apparently, her heart. She was evidently an enthusiast like himself, and enthusiasts soon understand each other. In the infatuation of the moment, Wolfgang avowed his passion for her. He told her the story of his mysterious dream, how she had possessed his heart before he had even seen her. She was strangely affected by his recital and acknowledged to have felt an impulse towards him equally unaccountable. It was the time for wild theory and wild actions. Old prejudices and superstitions were done away. Everything was under the sway of the, quote, goddess of reason, end quote. Among other rubbish of the old times, the forms and ceremonies of marriage began to be considered superfluous bonds for honorable minds. Social compacts were the vogue. Wolfgang was too much of a theorist not to be tainted by the liberal doctrines of the day. "Why should we separate?" said he. "Our hearts are united in the eye of reason and honor. We are as one. What need is there of sordid forms to bind high souls together?" The stranger listened with emotion. She had evidently received illumination at the same school. "You have no home or family," continued he. "Let me be everything to you, or rather let us be everything to one another. If form is necessary, form shall be observed. There is my hand. I pledge myself to you forever." "Forever?" said the stranger solemnly. "Forever," repeated Wolfgang. The stranger clasped the hand extended to her. "Then I am yours," murmured she, and sank upon his bosom. The next morning, the student left his bride sleeping and sallied forth at an early hour to seek more spacious apartments suitable to the change in his situation. When he returned, he found the stranger lying with her head hanging over the bed and one arm thrown over it. He spoke to her, but received no reply. He advanced to awaken her from her uneasy posture. On taking her hand, it was cold. There was no pulsation. Her face was pallid and ghastly. In a word, she was a corpse. Horrified and frantic, he alarmed the house. A scene of confusion ensued. The police were summoned. As the officer of police entered the room, he started back on beholding the corpse. "Great heaven," cried he, "how did this woman come here?" Do you know anything about her? Said Wolfgang eagerly. Do I? Exclaimed the officer. She was guillotined yesterday. He stepped forward, undid the black collar around the neck of the corpse, and the head rolled on the floor. The student burst into a frenzy. The fiend! The fiend! The fiend has gained possession of me, shrieked he. I am lost forever. They tried to soothe him, but in vain. He was possessed with the frightful belief that an evil spirit had reanimated the dead body to ensnare him. He went distracted and died in a madhouse. Here the old gentleman with the haunted head finished his narrative. And is this really a fact? Said the inquisitive gentleman. A fact not to be doubted, replied the other. I had it from the best authority. The student told it me himself. I saw him in a madhouse in Paris. Well, there you have it, folks. Washington Irving, not the greatest writer, but historically, he has his place in literary history. I read somewhere that he was the first person to be known as an author of a bestseller. I read that somewhere. I don't know where. I don't know the source. I don't know. Maybe I'm remembering erroneously, but I'm pretty sure it was Washington Irving, because I took an interest in him briefly. Pardon me. Okay, the next tale. Oh, oof. I guess we'll go ahead and read some Monroe, a.k.a. Saki. This guy's from across the pond, British. The Cobweb by Saki. The farmhouse kitchen probably stood where it did as a matter of accident or haphazard choice. Yet its situation might have been planned by a master strategist in farmhouse architecture. Dairy and poultry yard and herb garden and all the busy places of the farm seemed to lead by easy access into its wide flagged haven, where there was room for everything and where muddy boots left traces that were easily swept away. And yet, for all that it stood so well in the center of human bustle, its long latticed window with the wide window seat built into an embrasure beyond the huge fireplace, looked out on a wild, spreading view of hill and heather and wooded combe. The window nook made almost a little room in itself, quite the pleasantest room in the farm as far as situation and capabilities went. Young Mrs. Ladbrook, whose husband had just come into the farm by way of inheritance, cast covetous eyes on this snug corner, and her fingers itched to make it bright and cozy with chintz curtains and bowls of flowers and a shelf or two of old china. The musty farm parlor, looking out to a prim, cheerless garden imprisoned within high, blank walls, was not a room that lent itself readily either to comfort or decoration. When we're more settled, I shall work wonders in the way of making the kitchen habitable, said the young woman to her occasional visitors. There was an unspoken wish in those words, a wish which was unconfessed as well as unspoken. Emma Ladbrook was the mistress of the farm. Jointly with her husband, she might have her say, and to a certain extent her way, in ordering its affairs. But she was not mistress of the kitchen. On one of the shelves of an old dresser, in company with chipped sauce boats, pewter jugs, cheese graters, and paid bills, rested a worn and ragged Bible on whose front page was the record in faded ink of a baptism dated 94 years ago. Martha Crail was the name written on that yellow page. The yellow, wrinkled old dame who hobbled and muttered about the kitchen, looking like a dead autumn leaf with the winter winds still pushed hither and thither, had once been Martha Crail. For 70-odd years, she had been Martha Mountjoy. For longer than anyone could remember, she had pattered to and fro between oven and washhouse and dairy, and out to the chicken run and garden, grumbling and muttering and scolding, but working unceasingly. Emma Ladbruk, of whose coming she took as little notice as she would of a bee wandering in at a window on a summer's day, used at first to watch her with a kind of frightened curiosity. She was so old and so much a part of the place, it was difficult to think of her exactly as a living thing. Old Shep, the white-nozzled, stiff-limbed collie, waiting for his time to die, seemed almost more human than the withered, dried-up old woman. He had been a riotous, roistering puppy, mad with the joy of life when she was already a tottering, hobbling dom. Now he was just a blind, breathing carcass, nothing more. And she still worked with frail energy, still swept and baked and washed, fetched and carried. If there was something in these wise old dogs that did not perish utterly with death, Emma used to think to herself, what generations of ghost dogs there must be out on those hills that Martha had reared and fed and tended and spoken a last goodbye word to in that old kitchen. And what memory she must have of human generations that had passed away in her time. It was difficult for anyone, let alone a stranger like Emma, to get her to talk of the days that had been. Her shrill, quavering speech was of doors that had been left unfastened, pails that had got mislaid, calves whose feeding time was overdue, and the various little faults and lapses that checker a farmhouse routine. Now and again, when election time came round, she would unstore her recollections of the old names round which the fight had waged in the days gone by. There had been a Palmerston that had been a name down Tiverton way. Tiverton was not a far journey as the crow flies, but to Martha it was about almost a foreign country. Later there had been Northcotes and Acklands and many other newer names that she had forgotten. The names changed, but it was always Liberals and Tories, Yellows and Blues. And they always quarreled and shouted as to who was right and who was wrong. The one they quarreled about most was a fine old gentleman with an angry face. She had seen his picture on the walls. She had seen it on the floor, too, with a rotten apple squashed over it, for the farm had changed its politics from time to time. Martha had never been on one side or the other. None of they had ever done the farm a stroke of good. She was her sweeping such was her sweeping verdict, given with all a peasant's distrust of the outside world. Oh, peasants, are we? Sorry. When the half-frightened curiosity had somewhat faded away, Emma Ladbruk was uncomfortably conscious of another feeling towards the old woman. She was a quaint old tradition, lingering about the place. She was part and parcel of the farm itself. She was something at once pathetic and picturesque, but she was dreadfully in the way. Emma had come to the farm full of plans for little reforms and improvements, in part the result of training in the newest ways and methods, in part the outcome of her own ideas and fancies. Reforms in the kitchen region, if those deaf ears could have been induced to give them even a hearing, would have met with short shrift and scornful rejection. And the kitchen region spread over the zone of dairy and market business and half the work of the household. Emma, with the latest science of dead poultry dressing at her fingertips, sat by, an unheeded watcher, while old Martha trussed the chickens for the market stall as she had trussed them for nearly 40 years, all leg and no breast. And the 100 hints, anent effective cleaning and labor lightening and the things that make for wholesomeness, which the young woman was ready to impart or to put into action, dropped away into nothingness before that wan, muttering, unheeding presence. Above all, the coveted window corner that was to be a dainty, cheerful oasis in the gaunt old kitchen stood now choked and lumbered with a litter of odds and ends that Emma, for all her nominal authority, would not have dared or cared to displace. Over them seemed to be spun the protection of something that was like a human cobweb. Decidedly, Martha was in the way. It would have been an unworthy meanness to have wished to see the span of that brave old life shortened by a few paltry months. But as the days sped by, Emma was conscious that the wish was there, disowned though it might be, lurking at the back of her mind. She felt the meanness of the wish come over her with a qualm of self-reproach one day when she came into the kitchen and found an unaccustomed state of things in that usually busy quarter. Old Martha was not working. A basket of corn was on the floor by her side, and out in the yard the poultry were beginning to clamor a protest of overdue feeding time. But Martha sat huddled in a shrunken bunch on the window seat, looking out with her dim old eyes as though she saw something stranger than the autumn landscape. "Is anything the matter, Martha?" asked the young woman.
"'Tis death. 'Tis death a-coming," answered the quivering voice. "'I knew 'twere coming. I knew it. Weren't for nothing that old Shep's been howling all morning, and last night I heard the screech owl give the death cry, and there was something white as run across the yard yesterday. 'Twarn't a cat, not a stoat. 'Twere something like, but 'twere something. The fowls knew it were something. They all drew off to one side. There's been warnings. I knew it were coming." The young woman's eyes clouded with pity. The old thing sitting there so white and shrunken had once been a merry, noisy child, playing about in lanes and haylofts and farmhouse garrets. That had been 80-odd years ago, and now she was just a frail old body, cowering under the approaching chill of the death that was coming at last to take her. It was not probable that much could be done for her, but Emma hastened away to get assistance and counsel. Her husband, she knew, was down at a tree felling some little distance off, but she might find some other intelligent soul who knew the old woman better than she did. The farm, she soon found out, had that faculty common to farmyards of swallowing up and losing its human population. The poultry followed her in interested fashion, and swine grunted interrogations at her from behind the bars of their sties. But barnyard and rickyard, orchard and stables and dairy, gave no reward to her search. Then, as she retraced her steps toward the kitchen, she came suddenly on her cousin, young Mr. Jim, as everyone called him, who divided his time between amateur horse-dealing, rabbit-shooting, and flirting with the farm maids. I'm afraid old Martha is dying, said Emma. Jim was not the sort of person to whom one had to break news gently. Nonsense, he said. Martha C. means to live to 100. She told me so, and she'll do it. She may be actually dying at this moment, or it may just be the beginning of the breakup, persisted Emma, with a feeling of contempt for the slowness and dullness of the young man. A grin spread over his good-natured features. Don't look like it, he said, nodding towards the yard. Emma turned to catch the meaning of his remark. Old Martha stood in the middle of a mob of poultry scattering handfuls of grain around her. The turkey cock, with the bronze sheen of his feathers and the purple red of his wattles, the game cock, with the flowing metallic luster of the eastern plumage, the hens with their ochres and buffs and timbers and their scarlet combs, and the drakes with their bottle green heads, made a medley of rich color, in the course of which the old woman looked like a withered stalk standing amid the riotous growth of gaily hued flowers. But she threw the grain deftly amid the wilderness of beaks, and her quavering voice carried as far as the two people who were watching her. She was still harping on the theme of death coming to the farm. I knew we're coming. There's been signs and warnings. Who's dead then, old mother? Called out the young man. Sorry. "'Tis young Mr. Lodbrook," she shrilled back. "They've just carried his body in. Ran out of the way of the tree that was coming down and ran himself on to an iron post. Dead when they picked him up. I knew we were coming." And she turned to fling a handful of barley at a belated group of guinea fowl that came racing toward her. The farm was a family property and passed to the rabbit-shooting cousin as next of kin. Emma Ladbrook drifted out of its history as a bee that had wandered in at an open window might flit its way out again. On a cold gray morning, she stood waiting with her boxes already stowed in the farm cart till the last of the market produce should be ready. For the train she was to catch was of less importance than the chickens and butter and eggs that were to be offered for sale. From where she stood, she could see an angle of the long latticed window that was to have been cozy with curtains and gay with bowls of flowers. Into her mind came the thought that for months, perhaps for years, long after she had been utterly forgotten, a white, unheeding face would be seen peering out through those latticed panes, and a weak, muttering voice would be heard quavering up and down those flagged passages. She made her way to a narrow barred casement that opened into the farm larder. Old Martha was standing at a table, trussing a pair of chickens for the market stall, as she had trussed them for nearly 40 years. Well, there's a tale of buyer's remorse for you, huh? All right. Let's see what we can dig up here. Probably room for one last tale. You listen to me, your host, Norman Douglas. Name of the show, Good Night, Norman. Name of the radio station, WGXC 90.7 FM. Broadcasting out of Acred, New York. Sponsor under waveform.org. Go to the website. Give some money. Nobody gets paid around here. Well, somebody does, but not me. None of your programmers. But there are all kinds of programmers. I think there are even a few slots available if you're interested. Again, go to the website. Also, check out the events calendar. Lots of events coming up in April and May of all kinds. This whole drive-in movie thing with Brian Eno sometime in May. The music of Brian Eno, I think. I don't think Mr. Eno is going to show up, but I don't know. I could be wrong. I haven't looked at the deets. But there are other events as well. Screenings, picnics, you name it. We're not just, I mean, I'm not stuck in a studio right now anyways. But yeah, it's not just a radio station. It's a community. And look it up if you're in Hudson, New York. There's even public days where you can go by and hang out at the actual studio on Main Street in Catskill. It's a really small, modest studio. It could even inspire you to start something of the kind yourself somewhere. The Hand by Guy de Maupassant. We're all seated around Monsieur Bermoutier, the magistrate who was giving us his opinion on the affair at Saint-Cloud. The inexplicable crime had convulsed Paris for a whole month, yet no single being had solved the mystery. Upright, with his back to the fireplace, Monsieur Beaumetier held forth, marshaled proofs, and discussed diverse opinions, but he came to no conclusion. Several of the women present had risen from their seats to be nearest to him, and they remained standing, their eyes fixed on the clean-shaven lips whence issued such words of grave import. They thrilled and shuddered, devoured with curiosity and with that avid and insatiable love of the horrible that haunts their souls and tortures them like hunger. One, paler than the others, broke the silence. "It is terrible. It's almost supernatural. We shall never know anything about it." The magistrate turned to her. "You are right, madame. It is quite probable. We shall never know anything about it. But the word supernatural that you used a moment ago has no meaning in this case. We have before us a crime very ably conceived and very ably carried out, so wrapped in mystery that we are unable to dissociate it from the impenetrable circumstances surrounding it. But, in times gone by, I had to follow up a case where the fantastic element was really intermingled. We had to abandon it, however, and as no one was able to throw any light on it." Breathlessly, and as if with one voice, several of the ladies exclaimed, "Oh, do tell us about it, Monsieur." Bermoutier smiled gravely, as befits a magistrate, and continued, "You must not think for a moment that I fancied there was any element of the supernatural on this case. I am no believer in the abnormal, but if, instead of using the word supernatural to explain what we do not understand, we were to use the word inexplicable, it would be far better. At any rate, in the tale I am about to relate, to you, it was mainly the surrounding circumstances, the preparatory circumstances, so to speak, which affected me. Briefly, these are the facts. In those days, I was resident magistrate at Ajaccio, a little white town nestled on the borders of a beautiful gulf and surrounded by high mountains. What I had principally to deal with were cases of vendetta. There were some that were really magnificent, others excessively dramatic, savage, and again heroic. The most splendid subjects of revenge that a man may dream of, time-honored hatreds, momentarily appeased, perhaps, but never really extinguished, abominably cunning tricks, murder swelling into massacre, and actions almost noble. For 2 years I heard of nothing but the price of blood, of the terrible Corsican law which enforces vengeance on the evildoer to be borne by his descendants and near relations. I had seen old men,
children and cousins with their throats cut. My brain teemed with each happening. One day I heard that an Englishman had rented a little villa on the edge of the Gulf for several years. He had brought a French manservant with him, picked up on the way to Marseille. Soon everyone was talking of the queer foreigner who lived alone in his house, leaving it only to hunt and to fish. He never spoke to anyone, never entered the town, and practiced shooting every morning for 2 or 3 hours with pistol and rifle. Stories were rife about him. Some made out he was a great personage who had fled his country for political reasons. Others affirmed that he was in hiding for having committed a terrible crime. They even cited the particularly horrible details. In my position as magistrate, I wanted to gain some information about this man, but I failed to learn anything at all. He gave his name as Sir John Rowell. So I had to be content to watch him closely, but to speak candidly, my attention was called to nothing suspicious about him. However, as the rumors about him continued, swelled, and became common talk, I resolved to see him for myself, and I set about shooting regularly in his neighborhood. For a long while, I awaited an opportunity. At last it came, in the shape of a partridge, which I shot and killed under the Englishman's nose. Ha! My dog brought it to me. Taking the bird, I went and excused myself for my want of manners, and begged Sir John Broyle to accept the dead bird. He was a huge man, red-haired, red-bearded, very tall, very big, a placid and polite Hercules. He had none of that so-called British stiffness, and he thanked me warmly for my small civility in French, with an accent from over the water. After a month had gone by, we had spoken 5 or 6 times together. At length, one evening, as I passed his door and I saw him sitting in his garden astride a chair smoking a pipe, I bowed, and he invited me to come in and drink a glass of beer. I did not wait to be asked twice. He received me with the meticulous courtesy of an Englishman, spoke warmly of France and Corsica, declaring that he liked both countries and seashore extremely. Then, cautiously, I put to him some leading questions under the guise of a lively interest in his life and doings. He answered, without any embarrassment, told me that he had traveled much in Africa, Italia, and America, India as well. And he added, laughing, "Oh, I've had many adventures." Then I talked sport, and he gave me some exceedingly curious details gathered in the pursuit of the hippopotamus, the tiger, the elephant, and even the gorilla. "Those are all formidable beasts," said I. He smiled and replied, "Oh, no, man is the worst." And he laughed outright, with the hearty laugh of a satisfied Englishman. "Man was often my game," he added. And then he spoke of arms, and invited me to come in and look at some rifles of different makes. His sitting room was hung with black silk embroidered with gold. Large yellow flowers sprawled over the dark stuff and shone like fire. The stuff was Japanese, he told me. In the center of the largest pastel, something extraordinary caught my eye. A black object stood out in relief against a square of red velvet. I went up to it. It was a hand, a man's hand, no bleached and well-cleaned skeleton hand, but a dried-up black hand with its yellow nails, its bared muscles, and traces of dried blood. Blood smeared like mud on the bones, cut off cleanly, as if by a hatchet in the middle of the forearm. Round the wrist, a heavy iron chain was riveted, welded to this unclean member, and holding it fast to the wall with a ring strong enough to hold an elephant in leash. "What is that?" I asked. "He was my deadliest foe," replied the Englishman quietly. It came from America. It was cut off with a sword, the skin torn away with a flint, and then dried in the sun for a week. A good stroke of work on my part. I touch this remnant of humanity. It must have belonged to a colossus. The exaggeratedly long fingers were attached by tremendous tendons, which bore scraps of skin here and there. The hand was horrible to look at. Skin thus, it made one's thoughts turn instinctively to some savage and ferocious form of revenge. "He must have been a very strong man," said I. "Yes," answered the Englishman calmly, "but I proved it stronger. I put on that chain to hold him fast." Thinking he was speaking in fun, I said, "But that chain is of no use now. The hand will not try and escape. It has always wanted to go. That chain was necessary," gravely replied Sir John Rowell. I looked at him with a rapid glance. Had I to deal with a madman, or did he but joke in very bad taste? His face remained impenetrable, tranquil, good-natured. I spoke of other things. I admired his guns. I observed, however, that three loaded revolvers lay about the room, as if this man lived in constant dread of being attacked. I went to see him several times again, then I went no more. We had become used to his presence. He had become a matter of indifference to all. A whole year slipped by. Then one morning, towards the end of November, my servant woke me, telling me that Sir John Rowell had been murdered during that night. Half an hour later, I entered the Englishman's home, accompanied by the commissioner and the chief inspector of police. Overcome with grief and half-distracted, the manservant stood crying in the doorway. At first I suspected the man, but he was innocent. We were never able to find the murderer. The first thing I saw on entering Sir John's sitting room was the body lying on its back in the middle of the room. The waistcoat was torn, one sleeve hung in ribbons. There was every sign that a terrible struggle had taken place. The Englishman had died of strangulation. His black and swollen face, terrifying, seemed to wear an expression of awful fear. He held something between his clenched teeth and the throat, pierced with five holes that might have been made with fangs of iron, was covered with blood. A doctor had joined us. Lengthily, he examined the marks of fingers on the flesh and then quietly remarked, One might think it had been strangled by a skeleton. A shudder ran down my spine, and I looked towards the wall at the spot where I had seen the horrible skinned hand. It was no longer there. The chain hung down, broken. Then I stepped over the dead man and found between the tense jaws a finger from the hand that had disappeared, cut, or rather sawn, by the teeth, just at the second joint. Inquiries were instituted. Nothing was discovered. Neither door, window, nor furniture had been tampered with. The two watchdogs had not been aroused. Here, briefly, is the manservant's testimony. For a month past, his master had appeared restless. He had received many letters, burnt as soon as received. In a rage which approached madness, he would often take up his whip and furiously beat the shriveled hand chained to the wall, and which had been removed, no one knew now, at the hour of the crime. He went to bed very late and locked himself in with care. He always had firearms within reach of his hand. Often in the night, he was heard speaking with raised voice as if he were quarreling with someone. That night, by chance, he had made no sound, and it was only on coming to open the windows that the servant had discovered Sir John lying murdered. He suspected no one.
I told the officers of the law all I knew of this dead man. And a minute inquiry was instituted all over the island. They discovered nothing. Now, it happened one night 3 months after the crime had taken place. I had a most horrible nightmare. I thought I saw the hand. And the sinister hand running like a scorpion or a spider along my curtains and walls. 3 times did I awake. 3 times did I fall asleep. 3 times did I see the hideous thing gallop round my room, moving its fingers like feet. The following days they brought it to me, found in the cemetery on the grave of Sir John Rowell, who had been laid there as we failed to discover his family. The first finger was missing. That, dear ladies, is my story, and I know no more. The women were all shuddering, terror-struck and pale. But, exclaimed one, that cannot be the end. There's no explanation. We shall none of us close our eyes tonight if you do not tell us what you think occurred. The magistrate smiled as he answered reprovingly, For my part, madame, I shall certainly spoil your horror-filled dreams, for I merely think that the rightful owner of the end was not dead, and that he came to seek it with the one left to him. But I was unable to find out how he went about it. This was a kind of vendetta. One of the women murmured, No, it could not have been that. I told you my explanation would not satisfy you, said the magistrate, still smiling. Well, that's enough fiction tonight. It's enough speculation. That's enough stories for one night, morning. And that's enough for me, your host, Norman Douglas. Name of the show, Good Night, Norman. Name of the radio station, WGXC 90.7 FM, WGXC.org. Broadcasting to you live from the city of Hudson, New York, across from the town of Catskill. There's like 2 minutes left, so I'm going to do what any good community radio station host does, and that's ask you for some money. And this money isn't for me. This money's for the radio station. So go to the website, wgxc.org, wavefarm.org, and you'll see the donate button. Hit it. Don't quit it. Give it some money. $5, $10, $20, $30, $40. Meanwhile, something will be on the air. And it'll be coming to you here, from here, live, from Tower in Acre, New York. Next time, on the morning of the 14th, the night of the 13th. No, wait, that's wrong. 14 days from now will be the 21st. More speculative fiction from the fictional omniverse. I might even try to... Well, we'll just see. Okay, I'm going to say goodnight. There might be a 5 seconds of dead airspace, maybe 10, maybe 15, maybe 20. The more I count, the less time that will be. Good night. And as Edward R. Murrow said, good luck. Thank you for listening.